This is the first in a series of public hearings the committee will be holding as part of the House's impeachment inquiry. The questions presented by this impeachment inquiry are whether President Trump sought to exploit that ally's vulnerability, invite Ukraine's interference in our elections, whether President Trump sought to condition official acts on Ukraine's willingness to assist with two political investigations that would help his re-election campaign.
The witnesses deemed suitable for television by the Democrats were put through a closed-door audition process in a cult-like atmosphere in the basement of the Capitol.
It was unexpected and most unfortunate to watch some Americans launch attacks on dedicated public servants advancing U.S. interests in Ukraine.
I wrote that withholding security assistance in exchange for help with a domestic political campaign in the United States would be crazy.
It became clear to me that Giuliani's efforts to gin up politically motivated investigations were now infecting U.S. engagement with Ukraine.
President Trump was adamant that President Zelensky himself had to clear things up and do it in public.
Okay, so Hunter Biden's added to the board of Burisma. Now, do you think that creates a problem?
Sir, I work for the government. I don't work in the corporate sector.
You didn't listen on President Trump's call and President Zelensky's call?
I did not.
You've never talked with Chief of Staff Mulvaney?
I never did.
You never met the president?
That's correct.
This is what I can't believe, and you're their star witness.
A member of my staff could hear President Trump on the phone asking Ambassador Sondland about the investigations. Following the call with President Trump, the member of my staff asked Ambassador Sondland what President Trump thought about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland responded that President Trump cares more about the investigations of Biden, which Giuliani was pressing for.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. All eyes are on Capitol Hill as the House of Representatives kicked off its first round of public hearings in the impeachment inquiry of President Donald Trump. And today we heard from two veteran diplomats. George Kent, a senior State Department official, outlined what he saw as a dangerous mix of politics and U.S. foreign policy.
As a general principle, I do not believe the United States should ask other countries to engage in selective, politically associated investigations or prosecutions against opponents of those in power, because such selective actions undermine the rule of law, regardless of the country.
William Taylor, acting U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, revealed how the Trump administration communicated with leaders of a foreign government.
I found a confusing and unusual arrangement for making U.S. policy toward Ukraine. There appeared to be two channels of U.S. policymaking and implementation, one regular and one highly irregular.
The House Intelligence Committee has been interviewing witnesses for weeks behind closed doors, and transcripts of those interviews suggested a consistent narrative that the White House operated a shadow foreign policy carried out by the president's closest allies, and those efforts focused on Ukraine, and by threatening to withhold military aid, the alleged goal was to push the Ukrainians towards investigating President Trump's political rival, Joe Biden. The fate of Donald Trump's presidency is on the line as Democrats and Republicans make their case to the public. Joining me now with analysis is Max Kuttner, journalist covering the FBI, Justice Department, and Russia probes. Max, thanks for being with us as always.
Thank you.
There seems to be a clear difference in tone between the politicians that we tend to hear from and career prosecutors who we saw today. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. Today's format was a little bit different, where you had 45 minutes of questioning each from a lawyer, first for the majority, the Democrats, and then the minority, the Republicans. Usually it's a back and forth between the committee members. They certainly did less grandstanding. Their role seemed to be to want to bring out information from the transcripts that would serve their purposes, either the Democrats or the Republicans. And we knew ahead of time from our sources that this is how they were going to do that. And so for the Democrats, Daniel Goldman, he tended to say, Bill Taylor, you texted this. What did you mean by this? Or you said this. Isn't that correct? Really just to get that information out there to reiterate what is in these 700 pages of transcripts from Kent and Taylor. The Republican strategy was similar. However, they were asking different questions. They wanted to bring up corruption in Ukraine. They wanted to bring up whether this was or was not an impeachable offense.
And as we mentioned, most Americans have not read the 700 pages of testimony from Taylor and Kemp's closed door depositions. So there were a few moments that stood out, particularly in their opening statements and also during the prosecutor's questioning. One we heard at the top of the show, which was when Taylor mentions the two channels of diplomacy that the United States had set up, including naming names of who was in that shadow channel of diplomacy with Ukraine. Max, what were your thoughts on that moment?
Well, you know, we heard one bit of new information from Bill Taylor, and that was he discussed that according to Gordon Sondland, the ambassador to the European Union, Trump is more interested in a Biden investigation than in other issues with Ukraine. So that was the big piece of new information. And then, yes, as you said, he talked about this shadow diplomacy. He talked about there being this irregular channel led by Rudy Giuliani. At first, that was working apart from the regular channel. And then I think he used the word diverged from. And he said that as that divergence happened, he became increasingly concerned. He wrote a memo about this. He brought it up to higher-ups. So there was a lot in the Bill Taylor testimony about that regular channel versus the irregular channel, which was reiterating comments he made in his private testimony.
It's after the prosecutors took the stage, we've now seen something that's more of a familiar setup for many Americans during hearings, which is having lawmakers ask questions of both Taylor and Kemp. What is the Democrat strategy overall when it comes to questioning these two career diplomats?
The Democratic strategy has been to bring out information from the transcripts and get into how unusual all of this was, how unusual it was to have this irregular channel doing shadow diplomacy, how unusual it was to have a private citizen, in this case, Rudy Giuliani, being so involved in this, and even in the words of Bill Taylor, cutting out the regular State Department career officials who had been there for 20 years, 30 years. And so the Democrats, that's what they were trying to do. While the Republicans, on the other hand, you had Jim Jordan, for instance, you had Ratcliffe. These guys were using the GOP talking points that were leaked earlier this week, so we know how closely they stuck to them. They wanted to talk about, and they did talk about, how the security assistance that was withheld was in fact released without an investigation announcement that happened in September. They spoke about how this wasn't an impeachable offense. They spoke about the corruption in Ukraine. They spoke about how these witnesses today were not hearing the information firsthand, or even in some cases secondhand. Jim Jordan spoke a lot about that. They also brought up Hunter Biden. They were asking at one point about Hunter Biden's credentials. So they want to keep things focused on the 2016 election, on Hunter Biden, get things away from President Trump, while the Democrats really wanted to keep on how unusual this was. And also, the Democrats spoke about the dangers of removing security assistance and the importance of keeping Ukraine as an ally.
Republican members of Congress also invoked Joe Biden a couple of times. Basically, the Republicans are trying to say, well, this was the equivalent of what the president did, right? They're trying to draw some sort of equivalency between Joe Biden trying to, quote unquote, root out corruption to what the president was trying to do as well. Is that right?
Exactly, Tanzina. And then you had Representative Jim Himes, who's a Democrat, who made the point that this wasn't Trump, according to him, this wasn't Trump wanting to investigate corruption in Ukraine. It was him aiming corruption in Ukraine at a political opponent.
Taylor and Kemp are career diplomats, and they, in their opening statements, they made the point that they've worked under multiple presidents, Democrats and Republicans. How would you describe or characterize their performance in the testimony?
Well, yes, these guys are both careerists. George Kent today is in his characteristic bow tie and pocket square and three-piece suit. Bill Taylor has this, you know, booming, low, dramatic voice. And the Democrats use that to their advantage because they put up the text messages that Taylor had sent. They even had a little graphic with a text bubble and his picture on it and had Taylor read out the text. So you heard his voice in the background while looking at his texts, and people will surely think that was effective. So they are being praised today. I spoke with two people on the Democratic side, Democratic staffers. They were very pleased with how this was working out. One of those staffers is for Representative Jackie Speier, and she called them heroes today. And it will be interesting to see as this plays out on Friday and in next week's hearings how the Republicans treat these guys, because they are so respective. Treat all of these witnesses, because these are careerists, they're nonpartisans, and It started to get a little bit heated today in the Republican questioning, and we'll see if that continues on Friday and next week.
When you say heated, I mean, there were moments where it felt somewhat, dare I say, combative. There was a moment where, Taylor had to say, well, listen, it's not my job.
If I can just respond, let me just reiterate that I'm not here.
I've got 1 minute left.
I know you only got a minute left.
I'll withdraw the question.
I'm not here to take one side or the other. That's your
decision. Ambassador, let me answer this.
The general will suspend.
Do you think that strategy right now of the Republicans either being visibly frustrated or, using the word combative in their questioning, is going to be effective going forward?
Well, if we look at history, not necessarily. I spoke today briefly with Frank Bauman, who's the author of High Crimes and Misdemeanors, a book on impeachment. He said that this is a way that today's hearing diverged from the Nixon and Clinton impeachments. In those cases, politicians didn't claim that it was all a media conspiracy. They didn't attack the integrity of public servants. They didn't attack the other party. And in those cases, members of the president's party, in the end, did support impeachment. So that's one way that today was a lot different, and maybe that's the strategy for this era, the Trump era, this new century, or maybe it's not.
Of course, we can't leave off without talking about what's coming up on Friday, which is when former ambassador to Ukraine Marie Yovanovitch will testify. Tell us whether or not she came up in today's questioning so far, and what are you anticipating to hear on Friday?
Yeah, she did come up, Tanzina, and I think Friday is going to be a much different hearing because she was appointed under Obama. She was fired under Trump, whereas the two witnesses today, they were more careerists under multiple presidents. Now, we know from the other witnesses that Giuliani allegedly went on this campaign against her. One of the witnesses in previous testimony, George Kent, he said that Giuliani went to Ukraine, quote, to throw mud at Yovanovitch. He said that he did a campaign of lies against Yovanovitch. So I'm sure she will be asked about some of those comments on Friday and her own experience of being fired and whether she thinks George Kent's comments are accurate. That said, I think a lot of Friday is going to be about her subjective experience of being removed and of, you know, just generally what is going on now. She wasn't involved in the sort of conversations that George Kent and Bill Taylor were, which they discussed today.
Max Kuttner is a journalist covering the FBI, Justice Department, and Russia probes. Max, thanks as always for helping us make sense out of all of this.
Thank you.
And we asked you if you're going to watch the hearings and what you're looking for. And some of you have decided not to follow the proceedings.
This is Ron Little Rock. I will not be watching because I have a job. There is no law broken. There's no reason for impeachment. It's a waste of time.
I am Catherine in Juneau Beach. I have impeachment fatigue and will not be watching the latest round.
Hi, my name is Bill from Wilmington, Delaware. I don't plan on watching the impeachment proceedings, as I believe it will just be a partisan showdown. But I will pay close attention to the media recaps, in particular, looking for anything that might sway Republicans.
Hi, my name is Kevin. I'm from Seattle, and I will not be watching the impeachment proceedings. My mind is already made up.
This is Karen Rowe from Forest Park, and heavens no, I will not be watching. I'm going to raise my child and teach my students and all of the real-life things on my revolving to-do list, and let the people we've elected attempt to correct course.
I'm Gene calling from Dallas. No, I will not be watching because I think the Republicans are hypocrites and the Democrats are impotent. Nothing's going to happen.
Others said you'd be watching closely and you had specific questions in mind.
This is Jose Luis Moscovich from San Francisco, California, and I do intend to watch as much as possible. The main question I have is, can we impose jail time on government officials who refuse to cooperate with Congress? That, I think, would send a clear signal that there's no impunity to be gained from trying to game the process.
This is Elizabeth Abraham from St. Petersburg, Florida, and I am going to be watching the hearings, the impeachment hearings. I want to make sure that things seem fair and objective and that they're not just kind of one-sided. the whole country can see that we are following the Constitution and doing the best thing that we can.
Hello, my name is Gary from Boston, Massachusetts. Yes, I plan to watch the impeachment proceedings. My aim is to conclude if the impeachment is valid or just simply politics.
My name is Amanda Sowerman, and I live in Aurora, Colorado. I do plan on watching the impeachment proceedings. I will enjoy the educational and historic value the most because I imagine I will be asked where I stood during this period in American history.
This is Terry from Bergen County. I don't look at them as proceedings, really. They're technically an inquiry. And now it's public, and who speaks is really controlled by the Democrats. I would like to know how many Republicans are on the committee actively and how many will be given equal time to question the people that are asked to speak before the committee.
I'm Vanya, calling from Miami, Florida. I'm definitely watching the impeachment proceedings every day, almost like a binge-watching TV show or a soap opera. I think it's been very important because it's been helping the American citizenry understand how many people are put in place to make democracy work.
Hi, my name is Rochelle. I'm calling from New Orleans. I will be watching. I will actually record two different networks, CNN and Fox. I want to pay attention to who the anchors are. I want to know what's going to be on the banners across the bottom. I want to know what the editors think are important, what the producers think are important.
Thanks to all of you who called in to share your thoughts and questions. And here's what I'm watching for: how each side lays out its case, what types of questions the attorneys are posing, and how the media decide to cover the hearings, which is something we've been talking about a lot this week on The Takeaway. And you can always give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC, find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
While attention on Capitol Hill is focused on impeachment hearings, the Trump administration is taking steps to reshape the National Security Council. National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien took charge of the NSC in September after Trump ousted former advisor John Bolton. Last month, O'Brien said in a Washington Post op-ed that he would help the president downsize the council's staff. The proposed changes come right in the middle of the impeachment inquiry against the president, which began with a whistleblower complaint to the NSC's inspector general. But critics of the president say the timing of the changes raise questions about whether Trump is trying to downsize the council's staff in an effort to weed out whistleblowers. For more on this, I'm joined by Daniel Dresner, a professor of international politics at Tufts University, and Heather Hurlburt, the director of New Models of Policy Change at New America. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
So, Daniel, what exactly is Trump's latest plan to restructure the NSC? What are some of the details here?
Well, there's a couple things going on. First of all, Robert O'Brien, who's the National Security Advisor, has essentially proposed to downsize the National Security Council staff. And we should be clear, we're talking about the staff here, not the council itself. And the staff was up to over 200 people during the last couple of years of the Obama administration. There have been long-running complaints about perhaps the staff was too large and as a result was too outsized. And so O'Brien is proposing to essentially reduce it, I believe, from about 175 people to about 125 people. Those are rough numbers between now and January. And he's not going to do it by firing anyone, but rather most of the NSC staff is there through sort of secondments from cabinet agencies like the State Department or the Defense Department or so forth. And essentially, as those rotations run out, they're not going to be replaced. The other thing he's going to do is eliminate a few directorates, in particular the Emerging Technologies Directorate, the Strategic Planning Directorate, and I believe he's going to take the International Economics Directorate, and rather than have it report to the NSC and the National Economic Council, it'll only report to the National Economic Council now.
Heather, when we look at O'Brien's leadership compared to Bolton's, is this part of that overall strategy? He's only been in the position a short time, but how do you compare the two so far?
So O'Brien comes in saying, as others have in the past, that he's going to get back to what's seen as the golden age of the National Security Council under Brent Scowcroft in the Bush administration. And as opposed to Bolton, who came in with the idea that he had a definitive set of policy objectives that he wanted to push himself, O'Brien says that he sees the model as the National Security Advisor as the guy who tees up opinions and puts all the options in front of the president. Now, that's all great, but President Trump has demonstrated amply over the last few years that he's going to make decisions himself, he's going to go with his gut, and that he really doesn't care what kind of process you present him, that he, at some level, disdains the whole idea of a functioning bureaucracy is a little bit inimical to how he likes to hold authority. And as Dan said, this question of what is the right size for the National Security Council staff has been with us for multiple administrations. And so O'Brien is trying to edge back away from the Bolton model and wrap himself in the mantle of how traditional national security advisors behave. But there's nothing typical about this administration and pretending that you're Brent Scowcroft does not make you Brent Scowcroft.
Well, and Heather, Mick Mulvaney, we know, is also a fan of restructuring at the NSC. Tell us his position. What role is he playing in all of this?
So Mick Mulvaney, before he came to the executive branch, had a long history in Congress of never encountering a part of the national security apparatus that he didn't want to make smaller and less influential and less expensive. So Mulvaney comes to this with a longtime reputation as a budget hawk. And he adds to that clearly some difficulty managing Trump's various power centers and not a lot of sympathy for folks in the national security apparatus thinking that they know things or have advice that ought to be separate from his political process. So the other thing we should say is that O'Brien comes in as a fairly weak national security advisor, even for this administration, in that he was not a well-known public figure before. He has no political standing of his own. He has no wing of the Republican Party that he's representing. So in a way, it is wise of him to say, if I'm shrinking my own authority, no one else can shrink it for me. So I think that's a little bit of what's going on. And it would, you might think it would put him in a better position to work well with Mulvaney and others. But, you know, we've continued to have reports of people going around the NSC. I think we have some new stuff out about Stephen Miller. You know, this is not likely to make O'Brien and his work more relevant to the way this current administration works. And as Dan says, it's a little bit odd to be downsizing some of the functions that are most contentious right now and that are, frankly, most forward in the administration's own China strategy, economics and emerging technologies. So it's just, it's an approach that doesn't quite seem to match the problems, even if you leave the politics out of it.
And Daniel, to that point, I mean, will a smaller NSC or National Security Council have more or less influence on the president?
It will make no difference whatsoever. This is where I completely agree with Heather. There's an aspect to this where you're just talking about rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. Because essentially, the one thing we have learned very clearly from Donald Trump over the last couple of years is, A, he does not read any single piece of paper produced by his administration, and B, he operates foreign policy from his gut. So in that sense, the NSC staff size is an extremely minor element in all of this, because even if it was the best staff in the world, if they produce paper that's not read, then, you know, it's a version of the philosophical question: if a tree falls in the woods and no one hears it, does it actually happen?
And so what are the primary concerns on the left, Daniel, given this shakeup?
So you could argue, and again, this is a debatable proposition, but you can argue it, that essentially O'Brien announcing that he wants to reduce the size of the NSC staff, and most of the NSC staff consists of permanent employees of the government. Again, you know, career civil service, foreign service officers, military officers, that reducing the size of that is part and parcel of a larger theme of the Trump administration's sort of war on expertise. So what you want to do is get fewer and fewer people in any room that is making decisions that have any degree of actual core competency in the area that you're talking about. And so this would seem to be of a piece with that. Although, again, to be fair, there have been long-running debates about the proper size of the National Security Council staff. And in some ways, if this was a normal administration, there would be a genuine debate to be had about what the proper size should be, what right-sizing the NSC staff looks like.
Heather, there are impeachment hearings happening today. Can you help us make the link between those hearings and the attempt to reshape the NSC?
It's not clear that there is actually a link. And in a normal administration, these are debates that have kicked around in every administration. And in a normal administration, we wouldn't make the link at all. But it is remarkable and at the very least strange timing to announce your plan to downsize the NSC staff just as you have several members of the NSC staff being very prominent witnesses in the House Democrats' impeachment inquiry. So I am willing to give O'Brien the benefit of the doubt because it's very standard foreign policy talking points. Oh, you should shrink and right size the National Security Council staff. And I think they have very carefully gone out of their way to say the directorates they're cutting are not the directorates from which people have been trooping up to the Hill to testify. But it is certainly, it's a reminder of how much this administration likes to govern through chilling effect.
Daniel, Heather mentioned earlier that this is happening also at a time when, this has kind of fallen out of the news cycle a little bit, but the trade relations between the United States and China are being debated, if you will. How could this restructuring affect our foreign policy writ large? You mentioned the president is meeting with Erdogan today. He's met with multiple officials, senior officials in other countries that have raised a lot of eyebrows here in the United States, including Vladimir Putin. So what could this mean, if anything, for the broader picture when it comes to U.S. foreign policy?
Well, this is truly one of the more baffling aspects of this reform, which is if you want to say there's a distinction in terms of the way the Trump administration has thought about foreign policy substantively, there are two areas. One is that the Trump administration views China in particular as a leading threat, as the sort of paramount threat to U.S. interests. And furthermore, this administration has very tightly fused national security concerns and economic concerns. And we've seen that in the prosecution of the myriad trade wars, particularly with respect to China. So it is a touch odd that they are deciding to essentially eliminate the Emerging Technologies Directorate and, by all intents and purposes, downgrading the International Economics Directorate by not having a report to the National Security Council. And again, it's not like this will necessarily lead to any substantive changes, but the signal is unmistakable. You don't say, I am going to declare a war on drugs, for example, and then eliminate the Office of National Drug Control Policy.
Cory Shockey, who's a scholar and has also worked at the NSC as well as the agencies, reminds us that the purpose of the National Security Council was actually originally a political one, and it was as the post-World War II U.S. had suddenly sort of gained all this military power and influence to make sure there was political buy-in for how an administration was using it. And so if you think of overall the NSC as serving that political function as unifying the parts of a president's coalition, the message that the Trump administration is sending here really clearly is the president is saying, I am the arbiter, none of you is the arbiter, and all sort of playing off of factions goes personally through me. And that's very consistent with everything else about his presidency. It's not the way we tend to think about American foreign policy, but it does tell you something really important about how Trump wants American foreign policy to work, which is personalized.
Heather Hurlburt is the director of New Models of Policy Change at New America, and Daniel Dresner is a professor of international politics at Tufts University. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.